Lama Buddhai Jai Bim.
Jai Bim.
So I'm very pleased to be up here this morning, or this afternoon, to talk about Dr. Ambedkar. Obviously, it's very difficult to talk about Dr. Ambedkar and what he did and how he did it in such a short space of time. So I'm assuming that you all do know something about Dr. Ambedkar. And it's my very great pleasure also to be here with Jnanasuri, who's over from India, who was the first woman who was Indian woman ordained in India, and Kusala Devi, who works for Karanar as well. And I wanted to just talk a bit about, the theme of this weekend is about inspiration. And I wanted to talk a bit about how Dr. Ambedkar inspired Panti. So in 1950, the 25-year-old monk living in Kalimpong named Sangharachita wrote a letter to a fellow Buddhist living in India. Now, that's quite unusual, he said, because there weren't that many Indian Buddhists at the time. He's a very controversial figure who'd just written an essay called Buddha and the Future of His Religion. And Dr. Ambedkar sent him a reply. And in that reply, he said, "Great responsibility lies on the shoulders of the bhikkhus if this attempt at the revival of Buddhism is to be a success. They must be more active than they have been. They must come out of their shell and be in the first rank of the fighting forces. I am glad that you have started the Young Men's Buddhist Association in Kalimpong. You should be more active than that." So thus began a connection between Dr. Ambedkar and Panti, which an inspiration that was to have an enormous influence on Sangharachita's life and work. So we're talking about the lineage of inspiration this weekend. In 2009, Mahamati asked Banti what his inspiration was. What were his inspirations? He said, "Well, my inspiration is people." He said, particularly the Buddha, Milarepa, Dharmapala, and Dr. Ambedkar. So it's worth remembering that. Those are the people who inspired Banti. In a way, I suddenly think it would be really great to have a kind of order weekends on each of those figures, actually, and how they inspired Banti. And he said he was deeply influenced by Dr. Ambedkar because of his concern for the expressed and for the exploited and oppressed. He said he resonated very strongly with that concern, and he was very inspired by what Dr. Ambedkar was doing for the oppressed. And he said he was very influenced by the fact that Dr. Ambedkar undertook a peaceful revolution that was religious in nature. It was not superficial. It wasn't just about political, economic, and social freedom. It was also a deep transformation of mind. And he said that he has very, very strong feelings associated with both Dr. Ambedkar and his followers. In 1983, he gave a talk in which he said, "Perhaps among my strongest feelings are the feelings I have for these ex-untouchables." That's quite a statement. You know, Banti doesn't talk that openly about his feelings. To say that amongst his strongest feelings are the feelings that I have for these ex-untouchables, who we would call the scheduled caste or Dalits. So it wasn't purely an intellectual appreciation. It was a profound movement of mind and heart, a movement strong enough to change the course of Banti's life and work. So why is that? What moved him so strongly about Dr. Ambedkar? Why was this movement of conversion in India significant to Banti? And why should it be significant to us here now in the UK, in the West? Well, fortunately, Banti did answer that question directly. He said that the movement of Dr. Ambedkar and the conversion of the scheduled caste to Buddhism showed something very, very important. It showed that change is possible, and change is possible by spiritual means. Dr. Ambedkar tried many ways of ending untouchability. He drafted the Constitution of India, which is a wonderful constitution based on Buddhist principles. He challenged the economics of the time. He had a PhD in economics. He tried social action in various means. And in the end, he said, even though India has this wonderful constitution based on Buddhist principles, it's a palace on a dung heap unless you really transform mind and heart. So the great social changes that happened in India were brought about by a spiritual vision and by spiritual means, and were brought about non-violently. So I'd like us to really reflect on that, because think about the state of the world. We've just agreed another bombing campaign in Syria only yesterday. It feels like longer because it's such a terrible thing. We've decided to cripple an already besieged country. We've decided that violence is the answer. And the Save the Children think that maybe 80 to 90% of casualties will be civilians. At the same time, we have world leaders meeting in Paris to debate climate change at a point where it may already be too late to stop runaway climate change. The fact is, we don't know. We don't know the consequences of our actions on the climate. And here we have a vision. We have a vision of something different. We have a vision of a transformation of society undertaken by spiritual means, by the Dharma. And that is a very, very profound thing that we've got. It's a jewel in a mad world. And the way that that change happened began in the mind. It begins in the mind. First of all, you have to believe that you're a human being capable of the best and connected to other human beings, believing that you're capable of enlightenment. And that freedom of mind, seeing that you yourself can transform, leads to a freedom of action. Dr. Ambedkar made the point very, very strongly that it's Maitri, love, or metta, that underpins a functioning society. It's Maitri that builds fraternity, and that enables liberty and equality in society. All these terms have quite specific kind of meanings to Dr. Ambedkar, which I won't go into here, but what he said about them, he said he got the values of fraternity, liberty and equality, not from the French Revolution, but from my master, the Buddha. And it's Maitri that underpins all that. It's a vision of reality, seeing yourself as capable of the best and seeing yourself in connection with other human beings who are also capable of the best, who are united beyond divisions of birth and caste and race and sex. And this revolution of mind had repercussions in all other areas, in political areas, in economic areas and social areas. It's not a superficial change. So just to give you some figures from the 2011 census in India, because I haven't got anything more recent than that. 61.7% of Buddhist Dalit women are able to have female literacy, are able to read and write. That compares to 41.9% of Hindu Dalit women. So if you're a Buddhist Dalit woman, you are more likely to be able to read and write. You're more able to have literacy skills. 61.7%. That's a huge percent actually for India. And work participation in India is higher in the Buddhist Dalit community than in the Hindu Dalit community, in the Hindu community, in the Muslim community, the Christian community, Sikh community and Jain community. So basically, you're more likely to get a job if you're a Hindu, if you're a Buddhist Dalit, than any other community. So I'm just using some of these figures, there's many more actually, but just to show you that it has real tangible effect in society. And there's work still to be done, but you can really tell the difference actually. You can really tell the difference between Buddhist communities in India and other communities. So Dr. Ambedkar famously said the duty of a Buddhist is not merely to be a good Buddhist. His duty is to spread Buddhism. They must believe that to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind. So how much do we really believe that? How much do we think it's our duty to spread the Dharma, not only for ourselves, but for society as a whole? So I suspect some of us find that quite challenging, actually, because it rubs against a Western notion developed during and after the Reformation that religion is a private affair. So we have images of people standing out in the street sort of hassling shoppers. Sometimes I think it's like they're the sharks, you know, you just want to get your deodorant or something, and then you're walking through and there's these people coming at you from all directions. Maybe that's just Sheffield Fargate, but anyway. We can have this idea, you know, that that means pressurising people or taking away people's liberty. But maybe there's also a subtle view underneath all that, is that maybe we think that the Dharma isn't really that effective in society. I think that's the view we've got to really challenge in ourselves. Do we think that actually the Dharma is just about ourselves personally and can't really do much for society? Because I think the whole example of Dr. Ambedkar would question that. And Banti questions that. He thinks that the Dharma itself can change society. He said that change is possible, not only individual change, but change of a whole society by religious, by spiritual means, by spiritual ideals and a spiritual vision. I think this is the important thing. This is the lesson that we can learn. It's not enough to talk. It's not enough to think. We must see actual changes, changes in society taking place around us. And he talked about how he had sympathy with Dr. Ambedkar's what's called Dharma Revolution, and inspired him in his own Dharma Revolution in the UK. So he actually referred to his work in the UK in those terms, as a Dharma Revolution. He said that he wasn't concerned with teaching the Dharma in just an intellectual way, but teaching the Dharma in a way that people could make real changes in their lives. And he said those changes are different in the West. Often they're quite psychologically based changes, but they're real, they're not superficial changes. And he also said that he very much considers that we're one Sangha. We're one Sangha in that we're making real changes according to the Dharma, both in our own lives and in society. So that's the first sort of way that Banti was inspired by Dr. Ambedkar to really undertake the Dharma revolution of real change, real transformation, not just in individuals, but in society. But he also said that he was very inspired by the energy of Dr. Ambedkar and his followers. So Dr. Ambedkar, according to Banti, and I believe this is true, was a formidable character. He's called Bim Rao, Jai Bim. Bim means fearsome one, and it's also an epithet of the Buddha. And Banti said, well, that's very apt name for Dr. Ambedkar. Dr. Ambedkar had tremendous determination. He could have very easily given up at any point. He could have had a very easy life in the West, actually. He didn't have to go back to India and be treated in a low status, very, very difficult fashion. Even though he had two PhDs, you know, he was still treated like an outcast. He could have abandoned that. He could have just had a very nice life in the UK or America. But actually, he decided to use up all his energy in transforming society. And use up all his energy he did. He really, really worked for the emancipation of others. And this energy came from his spiritual life. He was a deeply religious man. I think sometimes we don't quite get this about Dr. Ambedkar, but Banti says it of him, and it's also clear if you read his writings. He was a deeply religious man. He believed that religion was necessary for society and necessary for the individual. He said, whatever good things I have in me, or whatever have been the benefits of my education to society, I owe them to the religious feelings in me. And he put, what's remarkable about Dr. Ambedkar is he put a big emphasis on personal responsibility. There's no victims in our Indian order. There's no one complaining. He really was very keen that people shouldn't become victims, that people should take responsibility for their own lives. And I think if there was one word that I would characterise in my relationships with the Indian Order and the people that I've met there, I think the one word I would say is dignity, and that's what I find deeply impressive actually about our order in India. Much more dignity than I think I have about my own spiritual life, and that's the one lesson that I think the Indian order teaches me personally, to have dignity. So, yes, he had a very big emphasis on personal responsibility and an energy and a passion for a revolution in society and in individuals' lives. But that energy and passion never turned to violence, even when violence was done to him and his people, which is an incredible thing to say in this world, as I said, who so easily resort to violence. And Banti experienced that energy for himself. He said, as we all know, the famous story of when he went to Nagpur and was giving hundreds of lectures after Ambedkar's death. He really felt that energy. It was almost like, he said, it was almost like a kind of overshadowing consciousness or suprapersonal force. But he said it was almost like also Dr. Ambedkar's energy. I think that energy flowed through Banti as well. And he said to himself that he was deeply moved by the faith, the gratitude, the sincerity, the fervour and zeal of Dr. Ambedkar's followers. And that had a deep effect on Banti as well. He said that he felt that they were becoming Buddhists out of a similar feeling to his own. That's quite extraordinary, you know. It came from a very, very different background. And yet he felt that those new Buddhists at the time of the conversions had similar feelings to his own. He said, "For them, as for me, there could be refuge only at the feet of the Buddha. For them, as for me, there could be refuge only at the feet of the Buddha." And this led him to understand more deeply that it's going for refuge that unites us as Buddhists, not lifestyle. Because he felt so personally connected to the feelings of the people of Dr. Ambedkar's followers. And those feelings led to great changes in people's lives. There's so many stories in India of quite remarkable transformations just through very small contact with the Three Jewels, with the Sangha in particular. In the West, Banti says, that we tend to be a little bit preoccupied with our subjective psychological states. I'm saying Banti said that because I don't want to get into trouble. Perhaps we might reflect on whether that's true. He said that in the West, we tend to move from the psychological to the spiritual. But in the East, we move from the social to the spiritual. And he said it's very easy for Buddhism in the West to drift away from public activities and retreat into subjectivity and personal practice. It becomes quite a personal arena. He said we could learn from our friends in India. And he said we could learn that Buddhism is not an option, but rather an integral and essential part of our lives. We could learn to not be afraid to be strong, to be controversial. We could learn to not let Buddhism degenerate into something he called weak and wishy-washy Buddhism. Mm. And actually, that's my impression from people in India. You might have, some of you who know me a bit better than others might have gathered, I'm not particularly cynical about the Dharma. I have quite strong feelings about it. And I think actually people in the West have strong feelings about the Dharma, but we tend to censor ourselves. We hold back our own zeal because we're frightened of the impact that might have. I think I really enjoy going to India because I just really enjoy having faith, you know, and just being able to say, Buddhism saved my life, you know, and I think it's a force of goodness in the world, and I'm not ashamed to say that. In India, Buddhism means freedom. And Buddhism means freedom for Banti, and it also means freedom from us, and for us. And I also believe it means freedom for society. So we're talking about inspiration. I did look up inspiration in the dictionary, and it says, fill with the urge or ability to do or feel something. So inspiration has to be something that's acted out in the world. It has to be lived. It can't just be held inside. So I think it would be helpful for us to consider what we might do for the Dharma revolution. And of course, the main thing is to spread the Dharma ourselves, to help the Dharma become a force for goodness in the world, to help people make real, substantial transformations in their lives. A second thing that we might do, this is a bit of a plug, is to help Kalyana Prabha. Because the first edition of Sangharakshita's complete works will have Bhante's book Ambedkarian Buddhism in it. And we're trying to bring that out next year, because next year is the anniversary of the 60th year since the mass conversions and Dr. Ambedkar's 125th birthday. So Ambedkarian and Buddhism has been out of print for a while, so it would be great to bring it back in print. But this volume will also include lectures Bhante gave on his 1981-1982 tour of India, where he gave 35 lectures, but they need to be digitalised. So she needs some help doing that, to digitalise those lectures, which is great, because then you also get to sort of see how Bhante was presenting the Dharma in those countries. I'm absolutely fascinated to see that. So the other thing you can do is take part in the 125th birthday anniversary, 60th anniversary since the mass conversions, of which there will be quite a program next year, partly organized by the India Dharma Trust. And you know, bring that into your centers, because people love it. They love it because actually they all want to change the world. We don't want Buddhism to just be another sort of inspirational quote on Facebook. We don't want it to become another platitude. We want it to become a real force in the world, you know, and people absolutely love the Indian order coming. They love those events to learn more about Dr. Ambedkar. It gives them faith and hope for the future. The other thing you could do is, of course, give money, because the India Dharma Trust, who funds the ordination teams in India, needs more money. And those ordination teams are magic. They go all over India and spread the message of Dr. Ambedkar and the Buddha. They run retreats, they lead workshops, they train people. So the Indian Dharma Trust has taken over the fundraising for those activities from Karanar. And I'm chair of the India Dharma Trust. And that's why I'm saying this. But I just wanted to say a little bit personally about why I'm involved with the India Dharma Trust. And to say that actually I'm... I don't know if this is right to say, it's not really actually to help out in India. I'm taking on that responsibility because I think Indian Buddhists are essential to world Buddhism. I think there's an alchemy that happens when you bring together the forces of the Buddha, Dr. Ambedkar and Sangharakshita. That happens in India. That's quite extraordinary. And we need that alchemy in this modern world. We need it in the West and we need it in India. It stops Buddhism sliding off into a private affair. It stops Buddhism sliding off into having very little effect on wider society. There's always the gravitational pull of individualism, lack of commitment and lack of engagement in society, the pull of consumerism. And that pull will pull in Buddhism and suck it dry. It really will become just another platitude on Facebook. Our Indian brothers and sisters in the Indian order give us is a radical edge. They keep that radical edge, and we need that radical edge in the West. We need the radical edge that happens with Dr. Ambedkar as well. So I think that the growth of the Indian order means the growth of Buddhism as a real force for goodness in the world, both here and in India. And in Asia, there's so much more work we could be doing actually worldwide. And I think that the Indian order has a special part to play in that. And we do too. We do too because we have a particular form of Buddhism that's about making real radical changes in our lives and in society. And we are one movement. We are one Sangha. That alchemy is also ours. Dr. Ambedkar had an enormous impact on Bhante, and Dr. Ambedkar is in our movement. We need that positive message. We need that message that to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind. And I would argue that we also need to feel a little bit of that revolutionary spirit. We need to feel that we're also partaking in the Dharma revolution. So I'll just end by saying that a quote from Bhante, where he says, "Planet Earth has a really wonderful opportunity, but it's in a quite terrible position. We can either have one world spiritually, at least, or no world. The choice is before us."